This is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
And I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week. And the album we're going to be listening to is Cream, Wheels of Fire.
Okay. I do know this one. I have it on vinyl.
All right. I know Cream. I don't think I've listened to one of their albums all the way through, though.
Oh, this is the double album, too, so.
All right, so, well, this is what it says on allmusic.com. It says, if Disraeli Gears was the album where Cream came into their own, its successor, Wheels of Fire, finds the trio in full fight, capturing every side of their multifaceted personality, even hinting at the internal pressures that soon would tear the band asunder. A dense, unwieldy double album split into an LP of new studio material and an LP of live material, it's sprawling and scattered at once, awesome in its achievement and maddening in how it falls just short of greatness. It misses its goal not because one LP works and the other doesn't, but because both the live and studio sets suffer from strikingly similar flaws, deriving from the constant power struggle between the trio. Of the three, Ginger Baker comes up short, contributing the passable Passing the Time and Those Were the Days, which are overshadowed by how he extends his solo drum showcase, Toad, to a numbing quarter of an hour and trips upon the Wind and the Willows whimsy of Pressed Rats and Warthog, whose studied eccentricity pales next to Eric Clapton's nimble, eerily cheerful Anyone for Tennis. In almost every regard, Wheels of Fire is a terrific showcase for Clapton as a guitarist, especially on the first side of the live album, with Crossroads, a mighty encapsulation of all of its strengths. Some of that is studio trickery, as producer Felix Pappalardi cut together the best bits of a winding improvisation to a tight 4 minutes, giving this track a relentless momentum that's exceptionally exciting. But there's no denying that Clapton is at a peak here, whether he's tearing off solos on a 17-minute spoonful or goosing White Room towards the heights of madness. But it's the architect of White Room, bassist Jack Bruce, who, along with his collaborator Peter Brown, reaches a peak as a songwriter. Aside from the monumental White Room, he has the lovely Wistful, as you said, the cinematic deserted Cities of the Heart, and the slow, cynical blues Politician, all among Cream's very best work. And in many ways, Wheels of Fire is indeed filled with Cream's very best work, since it also captures the fury and invention and indulgence of the band at its peak, on the stage and in the studio. But as it tries to find a delicate balance between these three titanic egos, it doesn't quite add up to something greater than the sum of its parts. But taken alone, those individual parts are often quite tremendous.
Okay.
Okay.
I think it's a good album.
I don't think that's necessarily a bad review, just sort of a mixed review. Like,
I guess.
Sort of saying that the band has individual strengths, but it's not... they don't work as a band. I don't know. But anyway, this album was released on the 14th of June, 1968. And the genres are psychedelic rock, blues rock, hard rock, and proto metal. And it was released on Polydor Records and produced by Felix Pappalardi. And yes, it is. So yes, it is split two discs. The first one is the studio version, studio recording, and the other one is the live recording. And so what we'll do is, since it is a double album, we'll treat it, you know, disc one and disc two as sort of for like the first half and the second half of the album. So if you are listening along with us, the album starts with White Room, and we'll listen all the way to the last song on the first disc, which is Deserted Cities of the Heart. And we do encourage you to listen along, and we've linked the album in the show notes to both Spotify and Apple Music, so you can get it on your preferred streaming service. So here we go. Here is the first song on the album, and probably one of the bigger hits that they had, White Room. So here we go. Okay, and ending disc one with Deserted Cities of the Heart. Yeah, I mean, this is, I mean, it's a Cream album, but this is pretty great.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, Eric Clapton, for all his faults, he's a great guitar player.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't know what that reviewer was talking about, because I kind of see what he's talking about. Like the, like the guitar and the drums and the bass are all very distinct. But I do think they do work well together in the same way that the Who works well together, that, you know, it might not be a tight band where everybody's kind of on the same page, but it's sort of like organized chaos in a way. And I'm kind of getting the same sense here. Like,
and yeah, I think you'll get that sense even more so in the live stuff, I think. So
that seems to be where this band kind of was, where they were at their strongest was live. I'm kind of getting that sense anyway. Although some of the studio stuff is pretty interesting. Like there was the one song that was sort of edited together. Was that with the Glockenspiel? Was that Passing Time?
Passing the Time, yeah.
Yeah, so like they're using the studio. Like they're not necessarily just, you know, setting up and in the studio and playing live. They are like using the studio as an instrument. So they are sort of exploring. I think they obviously are recording that way as well. I mean, they are, you know, they are a band, you know?
Yeah. I'd heard somewhere that, especially around this period, Eric Clapton would show up to the studio with his full Marshall stack, and he would insist on having it on full blast while he plays his guitar part. Well, to get that sound, it works.
It also does
drive the
the engineers crazy, because it's like you're destroying our equipment here. It's like, they probably have to put the microphone in another room or something. Can we close mic this? No. Get it as far away as possible. You know? we don't even need a microphone on it. Yeah. That's crazy. I didn't know. I mean,
I'd heard that he also uses Blues Breaker a lot, at least back in the Blues Breaker era.
You get that sound. I mean, that the Marshall stack, it's good live, obviously. You need that live, especially in those days when, you know, sound equipment wasn't great.
Now you can show up with a practice amp and they just mic it up.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah.
I don't know how true it is. And it might not have happened like all the time, but I think there were at least a couple of instances where that happened. So
I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, he can be kind of crazy sometimes. It, you know, it's funny, the relationship between Ginger Baker and Jack Bruce is, it's odd because they didn't get along at all.
They didn't get along in the back when they were doing stuff with.
Well, yeah, that's the crazy thing is they were in a totally other band that broke up, and did they broke up because they were fighting, right? Like, was that the reason?
Partly. I mean, I'm sure it was. Trying to think of the guy's name.
Is it Graham something?
Graham Bond.
Graham
Bond. Graham Bond organization. They were pretty cool too, but they were had a little bit more of a jazz thing, but they experimented a little bit, and it was like cross between jazz and like rock and roll and stuff like that. So, but they were pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the reason why that band probably split was probably because of Jack and Ginger's decidedly volatile relationship, and a lot of it goes on Ginger Baker, I think.
So, well, yeah, I've seen a few interviews with him, and I've heard other people talk about spending time with him, and he's not the easiest person to get along with. Neither is Eric Clapton, apparently, but yeah, Ginger Baker's all Ginger Baker. I've seen interviews with him just like cutting up other drummers. And like, you know, it's funny. It's, I recently read or listened to over the holidays. I listened to, Steve Gorman's book again, about the Black Crowes. And one of the things that sort of alienated them is when Chris Robinson would do an interview with a radio station or something, basically just insulting other bands. And the manager is saying, you can't do that. You can't insult like people's, like your fans' record collection, because your fans also listen to those other bands. And it's like you can say those things like when you're not in the press. I don't care what you actually think, but when you're doing an interview, don't say those things.
No, just going out and insulting other bands is pretty low. You know, it shows a certain disrespect, not only for the other band, but which I think was kind of the point. But yeah, there's a certain crossover between, you know, the fans of one band and another and a whole bunch of others and things like that. And you can alienate. I mean, sometimes there's beef that happens between like one band and another, and sometimes it's legit. Like one band is nearly responding to somebody else's low class act, and I can sort of, you know, understand that. But even then, to a point, you gotta, you know, let it go eventually.
Exactly. Yeah. And it seems like even when like Ginger Baker, he passed away not too long ago, but even up until then, he was still like, you know,
he's
never
been like
that. Outgrew that, you know, that sort of anger that he had. You know, it's funny, it's weird though that they would like after the first band that they were in, they would want to go and be in another band together.
Well, I think it was mostly Eric Clapton had sort of, he was unaware of really the Graham Bond organization after, for some reason. I don't know why, or at least was unaware of their, he knew volatility or something like that. Anyway, he had sort of recruited the two and they had both decided to join again, and was a little bit surprised when, you know, there you go again. Happens in the studio or whatever, a practice room or whatever.
Yeah.
What do you mean again?
Yeah, but I mean, they play well together.
They're very solid. I mean, the way they play, I mean, Ginger Baker does his thing, and then Jack Bruce does his thing, but somehow it melds together really well.
It is very jazz-like in that sense. It is very sort of loose. In that sense, yeah. But they create this rhythm that, you know, I was listening to, I think, what was it, Politician, the rhythm of that I think it's the one, like, they are locked in really tight together on certain parts. And I would think that also the anger is sort of fueling that, like, cause it is very aggressive. Like, Jack Bruce is playing very aggressive on his bass, and, like, you know, he's just like, you can almost feel the anger in him. It's like the frustration. It's almost punk in a way, you know.
Yeah, in a way.
So yeah, so with this album, like, we always talk about the question of like, if this album were to be released now, if this were to come out now, like, would it, do you, I think it would be sort of, maybe not mainstream, but I think it would be popular in that sort of blues, the sort of blues scene, I guess. Like, I think of, like, like Tedeschi Trucks Band, or like Marcus King, those kinds of bands, you know.
Yeah, I sort of see where you're coming from, but again, I think there's a lot more psychedelia going on in a lot of this as well. So I'm thinking, again, the King Gizzard route and other
it would
bands like that. There's a little bit of a crossover there. It's not like right down that aisle, right. But again, you would get, I would think, probably more along the Gary Clark Jr.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think you're right.
Where he sort of straddles the line a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, he's sort of like, yeah, the sort of the best of both worlds, like, you know, sort of fitting into that. Yeah, I can definitely see that. And, you know, the album, it was really well received when it was released. I mean, and like, it, in England, the critical reception to the album was highly positive. In a lengthy review, Chris Welch of Melody Maker began by noting, if Cream have been disappointing on record in the past, their long-awaited double album is sufficient to restore the faith of the most errant disciple, praising the group's taste and restraint on tracks like As You Said, and enthusing that the live disc was electrifying. And, you know, retrospectively, the album has been cited a classic of the era, writing in the Virgin Encyclopedia of Popular Music. Colin Larkin said the live disc captured the group at their inventive and exploratory best. In a 4-star review, Stephen Thomas Erlewine at AllMusic notes that the album is indeed filled with Cream's very best work, since it captures the fury and invention and indulgence of the band at its peak on the stage and in the studio. So, I mean, all around this, like, there is no, like, this, it's not like this album, you know, came out to poor reviews and it later became a classic. I mean, it was pretty much an instant classic when it came out. You know, it was pretty well received. And I think this was pretty much, I mean, Eric Clapton had already made a name for himself in the Blues Breakers and the Yardbirds, and so people were excited. It's like, oh, a new Eric Clapton band. Eric Clapton's in a new band, and, you know, they've got a new album. This is the third album, and it's, you know, it's their best. It's like the peak of their sort of output.
But, and as one review is sort of going on about, it's just like, and I don't understand the sort of the disappointment of the other bands or the other albums, because I don't know. I thought Disraeli Gears was pretty, that's a pretty great album too. Although it's definitely a lot more experimental in the, you know, lyrical side, and it's very psychedelic, and the cover reflects that. The first album was almost a straight sort of blues, but jammy blues album. I've got a mono recording of that one, and I like that album in mono because the stereo things were a little bit not quite right on that album.
So. It was, well, that was the 60s. I mean, it was the early days of stereo. They didn't really understand that you shouldn't pan everything hard left, or like you shouldn't pan the drums hard left and the guitars hard, or then the vocals hard right, or whatever. It's like,
yeah, it's kind of
like, you know, blend it a little bit.
Yeah. So mono recording for that first album anyway, it's pretty fantastic.
So I did manage to find a few facts, about three facts about the album. So the studio recordings, they were, instead of recording over a period of a few days, so Disraeli Gears was recorded only like over the course of a few days, maybe a week. And this album was recorded over the course of almost a year. And they would go into the studio in short bursts, you know, in when they would take a break during touring. So they would sort of record for a bit and then go back out on tour.
Yeah, and they got a lot of live recordings from just being on tour, and it took almost a year to gather all those together.
Well, no, actually it was, that's sort of part of the one of the other facts that I found, but the album was like sort of worked around their touring schedule. So they had a very tight, like they toured a lot. And so like this album is like, okay, you've got, you know, a week off, let's, you know, you got this song, let's record this song. And so it took a while for the studio album to be recorded. And so the plan was it was intentional from the start to have a studio disc and a live disc. Like that was the plan from the start going into the album. It wasn't like an afterthought or anything like that. And so the live tracks were recorded over three nights in San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Three tracks were recorded at the Winterland Ballroom, and one was recorded at the Fillmore in San Francisco in March of 1968. And this is something that's interesting too, is the album was released both as a double album and two separate single albums, both dubbed Wheels of Fire Studio and Wheels of Fire Live at the Fillmore. So two separate releases.
I've never seen the other releases. I've only ever seen the double album release.
It must be,
which is what
it must be, a collector's item. Cause I would imagine it's not, it must've been like maybe one or two pressings. Cause it's, yeah, like from all accounts that I can see, this was released as a double album. But
you know, yeah,
so if you out there have your hands on the single album version, you might have something pretty pretty valuable. You never
possibly
know. Never know.
I mean, early pressings generally are a little more valuable than other ones, and most of my Cream stuff is fairly early pressing, so.
But yeah, I guess we'll get back into the live album. But before we do that, let's hear from our friends over at the Six Picks Music Club. So check them out.
Hey there, I'm Dave, and I host Six Picks Music Club with my two buddies, Jeffro and Russ. We talk about six songs on a playlist that meet a theme to a topic that we've already decided on.
Just real quick, do you meet themes? Do you meet them?
Okay, no, I don't know. I guess What's the...
Russ, could I get a ruling on the verbal phrase, meet the theme?
Jeff, I don't know. I'm not fluent in the spoken word.
People just don't say meet the theme. They say fit a theme. And every week we talk about six songs that fit a theme.
All right. Okay, fit a theme.
Guys, we're going to have to re-record this.
Ah, fuck my...
Okay, and Dave, don't forget, it's Six Picks Music Club, not your dark web pod, Sex Picks Booty Grub.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Okay, and ending the album with Toad, a very long Toad.
No, but it's excellent. I love that drum solo. It's very few drummers can actually keep you engaged in a drum solo, even a 15-minute drum solo. It's just...
It's why a lot of drummers aren't... They don't do drum solos, because it can be very intimidating for them to... It's like, oh my God, I have to do a solo? But yeah. Also, a lot of them insist on doing solos, but that's another thing. yeah, no, the thing that I noticed about that drum solo, it's kind of obvious that he's taking inspiration from people like Buddy Rich, who would do like similar things. John Bonham also took a lot of inspiration from Buddy Rich, but his drum solos were more drum heavy, and he would use some effects and things like that, like flangers and phasers and stuff. And the one thing that I noticed with this drum solo that sets it apart from John Bonham's stuff is it's more... There was a section where he was like just washing it on the cymbals and just like it, which is a very jazz thing. Like jazz is more cymbals than drums and rock is more drums than cymbals. And so that sort of jazz element was coming in through. And yeah, no, it felt spontaneous, but you could tell that he had sort of different sections
planned out into movements.
Yeah, different sections planned out, but he didn't really know exactly what he was going to do in each section. You know, very interesting. Very interesting. I personally love drum solos. I think it's so cool when a drummer does a drum solo because it's something you don't hear that often. It's like, whoa, it's great to keep a beat. But it's like, whoa, I didn't like, it's pretty impressive when they can do all that fast stuff and everything. It's pretty cool. He's definitely got the talent. maybe not the easiest person to get along with, but he's definitely got the chops. And the other songs, I mean, that version of Crossroads, I mean, I've heard that one before, and what can you say, the guitar work on that? I mean, we haven't really talked a whole lot about Eric Clapton's guitar work on this. I mean, he's, what can you say that hasn't already been said about Clapton? I mean, he's Clapton, you know?
Yeah, back in the... Apparently back in the 60s, it wasn't uncommon to see drawn on the walls in like the subways, Clapton is God, after someone had, you know, went and saw him perform with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. People definitely have a tendency to overemphasize some things like that.
I mean, he's great. He is great. I mean, he's a great guitar. There's no denying that. Is he the greatest guitar player of all time? I don't know. I don't think so. I mean, he's definitely, for his time, for sure. He was doing some pretty
for his time. Probably. Stuff. Oh, he's up there. But you've also got Hendrix and you got Jeff Beck. yeah, it's really hard to beat any of them. But yeah, he's up there.
Yeah. And then, you know, like Jack Bruce, his bass player, like he's a really solid bass player. I mean,
he's one of my favorite bass players. And again, he's got the chops.
Yeah. Too. Really holding down the rhythm. And he's, I don't know his background. He's, I don't know if he's like a jazz guy, but he's definitely got the rock bass. Like he's really solid, just keeping the rhythm. You know,
he did start off as a jazz guy actually in like early bands and stuff like that. And the, well, there was like a jazz underground in the early 60s in London and places like that. And he was in a couple of groups then. So,
yeah, I mean, but as far as rock bass, I mean, he's not afraid to just lay it down and just be a solid bass player, really.
Yeah, he can do it all. Or could, anyway. He's not around anymore, unfortunately, either. Yeah. So,
yeah, so I mean, I think overall this album, it's interesting hearing the studio. It would have been cool to, I don't know, it would have been interesting to hear if they had two versions, like maybe some of the same songs from the studio side on the live side. That would have been interesting. I don't know if not.
Well, most,
you know.
Most of the songs, the live side, most of those songs are on like previous albums, like especially the first album, where I think Spoonful and I believe Train Time is on. There's certainly Toad is. Crossroads, I think, is it's a live version, but it doesn't have to be. It's good enough. A studio version of that wouldn't have beat it.
No.
There's not really much point in doing a studio version.
No, really. There isn't. You know, and sometimes that happens. Sometimes the live version is the version. I don't know, you like this I Want You to Want Me by Cheap Trick. I don't know if you've ever heard the studio version of that song, but it is nowhere near as good as the live version.
No, I've heard that a couple of times. Like, one example I can think of is some of Jay Giles Band stuff like that, and where the stuff in the studio was really good, they really shined on stage. Yeah, I'm trying to think of a specific example, but song direct titles are not coming to me.
Well, like the song "Nothing But a House Party."
Oh, that's like a
good
one.
That live version. I don't never heard the studio version, but the live version is just so full of energy, and it's like, whoa, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah, I love that. I love that band too. So, great band.
So this might be a difficult task, but what would be your three favorite songs on the album, three highlights?
Yeah, it's a little bit tough, but it's kind of hard to, I think Crossroads is definitely one of them. And I've always liked White Room, but then it gets a little bit tougher because then I got to decide between like Born Under a Bad Sign or Deserted Cities of the Heart, which is a really good song. And again, I really like Toad. It's just fantastic, but I think I'm gonna go with Born Under a Bad Sign. So Crossroads, White Room, Born Under a Bad Sign. Those are
solid choices. I think I definitely go with Crossroads as well.
Yeah,
I think I'd go Politician.
Okay, that's a good
one. And maybe Sitting on Top of the World. I really like that one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I kind of liked As You Said too, and I don't remember it from my album, but again, it's been a little while since I played it, but it just, they had that real psychedelic sort of thing going, like where he's singing through a Leslie. I thought that was kind of cool too.
Yeah. there's all these little moments on this album that are, I'm answering the question. I'm going to have to listen to this again, because it's like, it's one of those things where I think, you know, more you, it's, you think Cream and you think, okay, there's three of them. You sort of have this expectation. It's going to be like guitar, bass, and drums, but,
well, it is,
but it is, but it's so much like
going on.
Yeah. But it's like, okay, but they're doing some things in the studio that isn't just that. It's not just that. That's the bass, but it's like, okay, they're adding some effects, or, you know, they're incorporating some different instruments. It's like, okay, they're actually going somewhere. They're not just, you know, guitar, bass, and drums. So I'm answering the question is, yes, I will listen to this again, because I want to, you know, pick up on those nuances.
Yeah. I mean, would I listen to it again? I have listened to it several times. So yes, it's a definite yes for me too. So.
All right. So I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, if you enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And we would love it if you left us a rating and review wherever you're listening to this podcast, as it helps us find new listeners. And if you want to support the show, you can get these episodes the day before they go live. You can go to our Patreon, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. Your support makes a huge difference. And you can also check out the website, go to polyphonicpress.com. You can more information and updates, and you can get all the previous episodes over there. And I think that just about does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.